Today's Teisho is Case 83 in the Book of Serenity. Case 83 is entitled Da Wu Tends the Sick. Introduction: the whole body being sickness, Vimalakirti is hard to cure, the grass being unusable for medicine. Manjushri uses it well. How can that compare to calling on a transcendent person and gaining peace and well-being? Weishan asked Dao Wu, "Where are you coming from?" Dao Wu said, "I've come from tending the sick." Weishan said, "How many people were sick?" Dao Wu said, "There were the sick and the not sick." Weishan said, "Isn't the one not sick you, ascetic?" She? Dao Wu said, "Being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with him at all. Speak quickly, speak quickly." Weishan said, "Even if I could say anything, it would have no relation." Verse: When has the wonderful medicine ever passed his mouth? Even the miraculous physician can't hold his wrist. As though existent, he is basically not non-existent. Utterly empty, he is basically not existent, not perishing, yet born, alive without dying, completely transcending before prehistoric Buddhas, walking alone after the empty aeon, subsisting peacefully. Sky covers, earth supports. Moving on, the sun flies, the moon runs. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen at this wonderful sesshin. You know, some of us have been here for 5 days and some for a couple days, and some are only able to be here part-time. And I'm glad everybody is here. You know, this is typical, in some ways, it's been a magical sesshin. But, you know, actually they're all magical. And this has many characteristics of being typically magic sesshin. So you know, those of us who came on Wednesday morning basically went through a process that everybody who does sesshin goes through. So we have a couple people here who are doing the whole 5 days for the first time. They have had all of those challenges. One person, let me just say that, you know, whatever you say to me in Dokusan is confidential. I never tell anybody, ever. But I don't think they will mind my discussing just a few things that we've all experienced. One person came in on day three and said, you know, the first couple of days were really rough, right? And said, but I don't, the strangest thing has happened. It's day three and I have a completely different, I feel completely different, right? And if you have done sesshin before, you know that experience, right? It's like you come to sesshin day one and you think, okay, I might be able to do this. And then day two, you think, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. And, you know, when we have our sesshins at Murray Grove, day two, pretty much like the evening of day two is when people leave, right? So evening of day two, somebody will send me word that so-and-so is leaving. And I can hear the tires in the gravel spinning out, right? Trying to get out of there as fast as possible. But if people stick around until day three, it's like a transformation, right? It's something happens and there's a different horizon to things, different feeling to things. You're entering a different state of consciousness. And it's And if somebody said, well, how's it different? It might be hard to describe, but it's qualitatively quite different. And it's not as though your pain goes away, but you have a different relationship to everything around you, including your body. And this person said something else that everybody who has been to Sesshin has experienced, right? You know, you find in yourself, quote unquote, you find that at the center of your experience or at the center of your consciousness, there is this stillness, right? This imperturbable stillness. And that's pretty much how this person described it. And again, you know, for those of you who are old hands at this and those of you who are fairly new, you'll recognize that experience, right? It's like there's this, you know, day one is like there's a lot going on to handle, right? And then day two, it's getting a bit more difficult to handle. And day three, if you're lucky, you know, sometimes it's day four, but around day three, you find this place, right? This still place. And, you know, it's a qualitatively different experience, right? And somebody came in this morning in Dokusan to see me. And again, these are things we've all experienced. So I hope that person won't mind being quoted. But the person said, you know, this is a typical day five of Sesshin. You know, I ate something this morning that I basically would only have eaten for breakfast as a last resort, right? You know, probably out of food because of Sesshin, not going shopping. And this person said it was so delicious, so delicious. And again, that's a typical like day five experience, right? You know, day one of Sesshin, you're eating Sesshin food, if we're at Murray Grove, and you're eating rice, you're eating oatmeal for breakfast, rice and vegetables for lunch, rice and dal for dinner. It's novel, maybe it's not what you eat at home, it's kind of interesting, you're eating with chopsticks, that's interesting. You know, around day three, it's all getting a little old, right? It's like, well, let me guess, oatmeal for breakfast, let me guess, you know, stir-fried vegetables for lunch. Is it dal for dinner? You know, so, you know, but the interesting thing is around day four, it's so delicious, right? So delicious. And people, you know, we do have, Egbert was nice enough to collect the recipes, and he has a file that you can write him about, and we will send you the recipes. But, you know, actually, they're sort of standard recipes. It's not wizardry, you know. We all know that Imtiaz is an amazing cook, right? But nevertheless, you know, it's not wizardry, right? It's just good cooking, but it tastes so amazingly good because we've purified body, mind, and heart, right? And speech, body, mind, and word, right? We've purified ourselves through this process. And when we do that, the world is really a different place. It's a different place. It's qualitatively different, right? And you know, some of you have probably heard of Pure Land Buddhism. Pure Land Buddhism. And you may have vaguely heard something about it. You know, instead of doing Zazen, people in Pure Land Buddhism do Nyingpho. They recite lines from a sutra. Sometimes they just say a bodhisattva's name, right? So, in Japan, sometimes the bodhisattva is Amida. And in China, it's Amitwofo. It's Amitabha in Sanskrit, Amitabha. Amida Bosatsu, and this is the Pure Land Buddha. Pure Land Buddha, and you might think, what's that all about? You know, but actually, very profound practice, right? I mean, by day five of Sesshin, we're in the pure, this is the pure land. We're creating our pure land. We're doing it together, you know, and it's a pure land on day five, right? We've been working hard 8 or 9 hours a day, purifying our body, mind, and heart. And now we're in a different world, right? It's just, I hope you have had a taste of this, you know, because, you know, most people who came to this Sesshin on Wednesday, you know, let's face it, I mean, in a certain way, the world is very far from a pure land. And, you know, we all came here in I think various degrees of emotional distress, frustration, anger, and that sense of helplessness, right? And then we set to work, you know, on this this unbelievably beautiful practice, right? We started doing our zazen and watching the breath and entering mushi and struggling with our koans, right? But the end result is, you know, something really quite amazing. You know, and it's hard work to work through your karma, because it's not just your karma, right? It's the whole system's karma. You know, there's so much negativity out there and so much destructiveness and anger. And, you know, we say, well, that's out there, I'm separate from that. But it's not really true, right? It's not really true. There is a separation that's legitimate. But, you know, we're all sort of drawn into that vortex. There's no question about it. And, you know, people can easily get caught up in this, you know. My wife, for years and years, used to make fun of me because I'm a NPR addict, you know. So when I would drive up, you know, when I drive up to the Sunday Sit in Stanhope, and I used to do that, I would listen to the cooking show. You know, I love that cooking show, The Splendid Table. And I, you know, I actually have like a little notebook. I'll get ideas, you know. You know, when I drive home, I listen to On the Media, you know. When it's 5 o'clock, I stop working and I listen to NPR. You know, I listen to the, you know, All Things Considered in the morning. And my wife used to make fun of me. And she said, you know, why do you do that to yourself? Now I come home after sitting at night and she's glued to the TV and she's watching Rachel Maddow and MSNBC and she's, you know, getting steamed up, you know. It's so easy to do. We get caught up in that vortex. But, you know, that place enhances our sense of powerlessness and produces anger, right? And often directed against ourselves, right? Often because when we can't change our circumstances, we blame ourselves. So you know, coming here is so important. It's so precious to liberate yourself from those mental habits. And, you know, what's happening is that, you know, there's like in the Buddhist way of thinking, there's like three, they're called dharma bodies, dharma bodies, right? There's your intrinsic Buddha nature, which is luminous and compassionate. And that's called the dharmakaya, okay, the dharmakaya. Then there's another body, which you could call the transformation body. The transformation body. And that's the world we live in, this ever-changing reality, right? Where, you know, this is supposed to happen and this is supposed to happen. And it's highly unstable. But actually, the fact that it's changed so changeable is really wonderful, because we can, just as things can unexpectedly change in a new direction, we can change too in a new direction. So, you know, in Buddhist mythology, there are different levels of being, different kinds of beings. And there are gods in heaven, you know, basically. But, you know, the gods are cannot wake up. One of the key Buddhist teachings is gods cannot wake up. And you can say, well, why can't they wake up? But the gods can't wake up because they can't change fast enough, right? So, like, the god of war is just war. You know, he's never going to be the god of war. The god of fire is just fire. You know, he's never going to be the god of water. And so on. Animals in Buddhist thinking, traditional Buddhist, they are wrong, of course. We know a lot more about animals. But the idea of is animals change in ways that can't be controlled, right? So animals are like changing all the time, and they can't change. They can't alter their destinies, right? That's the theory. But humans are like between gods and animals in this way of thinking. I don't accept it. I think we're an animal, but in this way of thinking, we're at the sweet spot because we're capable of changing ourselves. We're capable of changing our energy habits, right? So, you know, if you get depressed because of the events, you know, one of the things you might do is decide, you know, I'm just going to sleep in because what the hell, you know, I'm just going to sleep late. And you just sleep late. And some people need to sleep late. You know, different people have different biological clocks. But you know, you come to Sesshin and suddenly you have to get up earlier, right? And it's painful and difficult for a while to get up earlier. And, you know, as you know, our regular Sesshin start at 5 in the morning. So you have to get up at 4. Because we're living at home and we have a compressed schedule, people can come in at 7, but it's still pretty early, right? You know, and at first you think, I really don't like this. You know, this is very uncomfortable. It's like, oh my, I have to get up now? You know, and you want to just lean over and hit the alarm clock, but you don't do it. You say, okay, I said I was going to go to Sesshin. And, you know, this is what happened to me. You know, when I started studying at the Seattle Zen Center with Genki Roshi, we had sitting at 5 o'clock. And I had to get, actually 5:30. I had to get up every morning and get ready for my job as a TA, get my clothes on, wash my face and everything, get my books together. And then John Sunston would pick me up and we would all drive down to the Zen Center together. And, you know, I was the kind of person who liked to get up at like the crack of noon, you know, you know, this was like earth shattering to me. I was sort of like hallucinating for a couple of weeks, right? And then one day we were driving down to the Zen Center, and I don't know if you know Washington, Seattle, Washington, but it's in the middle of a bunch of big lakes, and you have to drive over bridges, and we were driving over the Lake Washington Bridge, and the sun was coming up, right? And there are these beautiful hills, and the sun is coming up, and the water was absolutely mirror-like. And for the first time in my life, I thought, you know, getting up early is actually pretty nice, pretty nice. And then we would go to the Zen Center and sit, you know, and it's a habit I have never given up. I get up at like 5 pretty much every day. If I really want to be, you know, wildly self-indulgent, I get up at 5:30, you know. But I'm not bragging about getting up. I'm just saying, you know, we are much more flexible and changeable than we imagine. You know, we can completely change who we are. And even if we have lots of negative energy habits, and even if they feel impossible to alter, you know, we live in the transformation dimension, you could say, the transformation dimension. And you can completely remake yourself. And in a way, that's what Zen is all about. It's about restructuring your consciousness, right? Rebuilding your consciousness. So we go to Mushin, which is like the zero. It's called in Sanskrit, it's shunyata, emptiness, zeroness. We go to zeroness, right? And it, you stay in zeroness, and it's like all the memory banks are being cleaned out, basically. You know, it's like deconditioning. And it's also a form of consciousness. But, you know, at the very least, you're sort of getting to a place where you can now experience the world in a fresh way. And the koan is a subliminal cue or an unconscious cue. So, you know, basically the koan is saying, go into a blank mind and process this cue, this subtle hint. Treat it like a mantra, and you're going to notice something about the moment that you have never, that you've walked past all your life because you've been seeing it in these stereotyped ways, you know, and one day, you know, you might come into the teacher and say, you know, I can't believe it. I was listening to a bird and I became the bird, right? And, you know, and your discriminating mind says that's not possible, but experientially, it was a totally different way of hearing the bird, right? Normally we hear something and we think, oh, bird, or, you know, my friends who are birders hear a bird and they go, oh, that's a Carolina thrush, you know, and but, you know, it's possible to experience the sound of the bird as the self, right? And, you know, what's happened then is you're transforming your consciousness. You're transforming your consciousness and you're, that's what I mean by purifying body, mind, and heart. You're now starting to experience the world in a way that's more whole, more connected, less fearful, and so on. And koan training is building your world back up from zero, sort of one experience at a time, one moment at a time. And little by little, the world you live in becomes beautiful and alive, right? And if you've done some sesshins, you know this, you know. When you're on the way to sesshin, sometimes you hardly notice anything. And then, you know, I remember going to a sesshin long ago, and we came out of the sesshin. I was driving with Web Roshi, and he stopped at a quick check, you know, and he wanted to get something from the store. And I was sitting in the car, and as I just turned on the radio, right, and there was some kind of bubblegum music on, you know. It was like, oh baby, baby, baby. Oh, baby, you know, it was like listening to Mozart, right? It was just like so beautiful, right? And I don't think that was an illusion. I think it was like a more, you know, it was a deeper experience of sound, deeper experience, you know, experience of my world, right? You know, so when we practice Zen, we're getting closer to the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is Buddha mind, the Buddha body. And that is at the center of our consciousness, but we can't get to it because we've acquired all these mental habits that screen it off. And when we begin to practice Zen, when we begin to purify body, mind, and heart, use Mushin to decondition ourselves and rebuild. See, we're gradually taking away the barriers to Buddha mind. And Buddha mind begins to be, as we get closer to Buddha mind, we feel better. We feel more energetic. We feel more alive. We feel more compassionate. And as that's happening, it's like, that Buddha mind is like, you could say, like infusing our experience, if this makes any sense. It's like the, as we clear away obstacles, this radiant, enlightened mind begins to like infuse our experience. It's like pulling back curtains and the light is coming in and it's showing things around us in a new light. Sort of everything was sort of gray. We open the curtain and now everything, you realize this is a beautiful red and this is, this is how gorgeous this bowl is, you know, this idea. And so it's now like infusing enlightened mind into our everyday experience, you could say. And that's the third dimension. See, there's that Buddha, there's the Dharmakaya, which is the Buddha mind. There's the transformation realm, right? And when we purify the transformation realm, it becomes the, you could say, the enjoyment realm, or the happiness realm, or you could say the pure land. It becomes the pure land. So you know, as we purify body, mind, and heart, we begin to experience the world around us in a different way. It's like it's infused with enlightened mind. And when we infuse things with enlightened mind, the world becomes the pure land. See? So we're all like, if somebody says, what kind of Zen, what kind of Buddhism do you do? You can say, I do Buddhism, but I was at a, I do Zen rather, but I was at a Sesshin and we were creating the pure land. They won't know what you're talking about. But we've been creating the pure land here. And, you know, there's no other way, in my opinion, to change the world, in my opinion. You know, so, you know, I'm very happy that Joe Biden is president of the United States, you know, and I'm so happy, I can't even describe it. But, you know, the same sort of mental habits that have gotten into this mess are still out there. And, you know, there's no way to mass produce what's happening to us, right? I mean, there's no way to, you know, maybe someday somebody will invent something where, you know, if you listen to this music, it will clear away your karmic obstacles or something. And we can get some music star to sell this and everybody will buy it and they'll listen and then they'll be purified, right? Every once in a while, you see these gadgets people sell that are supposed to help you, you know, but they don't work. But it's probably the case that, you know, the best hope, in my opinion, for a better world is just what we're doing. You know, it's true that this is only about maybe 30 some people have participated in some part of the Sesshin. There's like 8 billion people, but all the same, you know, this is where it starts. You know, the world will be a better place because you've created the pure land here at this Sesshin. So anyway, thank you for joining in this great enterprise. You know, sometimes societies do become better, and I think it's because the culture gives people ways of doing just what we're doing. You know, I really do. This could make a big difference if more people did it. Okay, so here's the koan. Guishan asked Dao Wu, where are you coming from? Dao Wu said, I come from tending the sick. How many people were sick? There were the sick and the not sick. So, you know, basically, we're all kind of sick, right? I mean, I think that's true. You know, we were sick. I've been trying to suggest during this Sesshin, because we respond in the wrong way to our helplessness, right? And all of us are helpless. You know, if you think about it, babies are absolutely helpless. And, you know, they're utterly dependent on the kindness and attentiveness of their mothers and other people who are their caregivers. And that's how we begin our life. And, you know, we think that we leave our helplessness behind, but we don't. You know, I think helplessness, the experience of helplessness, is our ground floor. It's really where we are all our lives. And we pretend that we have control over things, but we really don't. And, you know, that's so hard to admit because it's a little, as I've been saying this week, it's a little scary to admit, you know, that everybody knows this, but, you know, we all know how we're living by, you know, we're living like the birds, we're living like fish, you know, we control really very little. You know, you could get in your, the cliche is you could get in your car tomorrow and have an accident, but, you know, so many things could happen. Our existence is very precarious, right? It just is. And, you know, we want to escape from that condition by becoming powerful, by getting control, right? And in fact, even, you know, people get into Buddhism for that reason. You know, I mean, look at it this way. The Buddha is a unique, historically unique individual who achieved complete and unadulterated enlightenment. You know, he has total wisdom according to some Buddhist traditions. He knows everything and so on and so on. And, you know, sometimes people identify with the Buddha because it's like, there, see, I can do it. I can become godlike. I can become indestructible or invulnerable, right? But I'm always moved by the fact, you know, when the Buddha was trying to wake up, as you probably know this story, he almost died. He was so intent on waking up, on becoming enlightened, that he tried starving himself to death. This was one of the many strategies he used to try to wake up. And he and his five companions just went on a fast. It was like a fast to the death. He was like eating one grain of rice a day, and they didn't want to die. They thought if they pushed themselves to the edge of death, they might see something beyond this life, basically. And of course, the Buddha almost was on the edge of death, and he finally realized, this is for the birds. You know, I have to eat something. So he left, and he left his five companions, and he walked towards a village, and a little girl, seeing this emaciated beggar, made a bowl of rice and milk for him. And the sutras say that he ate that, and it restored his strength. And he went away, and he sat down, and he had his great awakening experience. So, you know, it's just a simple kindness of this girl, you know, this generosity of this little farm girl that made it possible for the great Buddha to wake up, right? And if we think about it, you know, think of all the people in your life who have helped you, have made your life possible. You know, all the people, not just your parents, right? I mean, parents are difficult to deal with sometimes. But nevertheless, you know, think of all the people in your life who have made it possible for you to live your life. You know, when I was 13 years old, I got scarlet fever. I almost died. You know, most people don't get scarlet fever anymore. But there was just this. I was thinking about him this morning. This general practitioner named Dr. DeBord, and he diagnosed this correctly when a bunch of specialists didn't diagnose it right, and he gave me some medicine that really prevented me from dying. I was like within a hair's breadth of dying, right? You know. So there's so many. I had a teacher in the 10th grade, Mrs. Brown, who really got me interested in literature. And, you know, I had a professor at the university who would actually, I would come to his office and just dump on his desk all of these stupid ideas. And he would, I remember now, he would just listen so patiently. It was like, you know, these things were so so childish. My thinking was like so silly, but he was so patient and so kind to me. And he would sit there and just listen, and he'd ask me a few questions, and I felt so inspired, you know, by him. So, you know, he died a long time ago. Like all of us, he is a fragile, transient person. But he made a huge difference in my life, you know. And I think that is a helping people is the best possible response to our helplessness, right? So one way to respond to helplessness is with anger and self-loathing. But being helpful to others is a very different way of responding to our helplessness. And I think it's absolutely, I think it makes everything into the pure land. It makes everything into the pure land. You know, I didn't understand this for a long time. When I started doing Zen, I was very unhappy person. And I was trying to be invulnerable. I really thought this is my ticket. You know, I'm going to become this all-knowing, super wise, indestructible person. I really think that was kind of an unconscious motivation. And you know, I practiced like hell. And I mentioned that for 4 years, I couldn't really answer the breath perception koan. All I had to do was come in and say something about my breath beyond the fact that it goes in and out my nose. So if you watch the breath after a while, your mind becomes blank. If I had said that, Genki Roshi would have passed me in a month. But I was so obsessed with saying something that would impress him and that would show that I was a special person, you know, that I couldn't see what was right in front of me. And I couldn't see what was right in front of me. So, you know, actually, eventually, Genki Roshi asked me to be the tenzo, the cook. You know, in our system here, we have people who sort of volunteer, like Imtiaz or Egbert, who volunteer to work in the kitchen and prepare the meals. And we've got a system where nobody has to be the cook all the time. It's a pretty good system. But in most Zen centers, they pick somebody to do all the cooking for 6 months, or sometimes even a year. So, you know, you're asked to give up your opportunity to practice at Sesshin and just dedicate yourself to caring for others. And it means, you know, you're not going to be working on your koans. You're not going to be sitting 8 hours a day. You're going to be in that kitchen a lot. And Genki Roshi asked me to do this, and I felt so bummed out. You couldn't really say no, right? But it was like, oh, man, I'm going to be losing my precious practice time, my opportunity to become an invulnerable person, right? But I agreed. And I have worked in the food business. Before I had done this, one of my many jobs was working in Italian restaurants for a while. I went into that business after being in the moving business, you know. So I actually know my way around food quite well. And at the Sesshin, at this one Sesshin, I decided to really give it a try, really make good food. And I used my restaurateur skills. And I baked bread. I did all this stuff. And the food was, if I may say so, the food was delicious. I made vegetarian food with béarnaise sauce. If you know anything about béarnaise sauce, it's not easy to make. It's very bad for you. It's loaded with cholesterol. But I made béarnaise sauce. I did stuff like that. And everybody, I used to peek through the door. I could look out the door and see everybody eating, and their faces were like, this is delicious, right? So, you know, I would make rolls and leave them out at the end of the day. People would come by after sitting all day. And anyway, I really got into it totally unexpectedly. It was not, I experienced the joy that comes from helping other people. And it was like joyous, and it was totally unexpected. I did not expect this, you know. I had no idea you could get such pleasure from helping other people. And that sounds astonishing, but the way I was raised, nobody told me that that was the case, right? So anyway, at the end of the session, Genki Roshi called me into Dokusan. And he said, you know, you've never answered your breath perception koan. But, you know, this is the first time I've ever seen you do something that's genuinely bigger than yourself, right? Helping others. This is the first time I've ever seen you help others. Something beyond yourself, right? And he said, so I'm passing you on the call anyway. Right? So, you know, it's interesting. You can't really, how should I put it? You know, the problem with feeling helpless is that it's an extreme case of feeling detached. Helplessness is an illusion. It's an illusion, but it's the ultimate in like our sense of separation from everything around us. It's the ultimate in it's samsara. Helplessness is samsara, right? It's the ultimate disconnected state. And the thing is, you can't really get out of selflessness, I mean, out of helplessness, by trying to help yourself, in my opinion. I really don't think you can, because that doesn't solve the problem of the isolation that creates your sense of helplessness. You know? So when the more you try to help yourself, I think, in a certain way, out of your helplessness, the more you just get caught up in it again. It's just my opinion. Could be wrong. You know, I'm wrong about many things. But my feeling is, you know, helping others builds back those connections of trust between people and between yourself and life. See? And, you know, to cook for people is such a wonderful gift, right? Because, you know, they may not thank you. They may not like what you made. And it's really not about them. It's about giving. It's about giving to them, right? You're creating the pure land. You're creating the pure land. So the way out of our helplessness is to help. And it doesn't matter whether people want our help, you know, actually, or appreciate our help. You know, it was nice to see people enjoying my food at Sashin, you know. And it was unbelievably wonderful. But, you know, creating the pure land, connecting, restoring those broken connections of trust in the world. Rishan asked Dawu, where are you coming from? I've come from tending the sick. I'm sick. I need to come to Sashin too. The joy of this is the joy of this practice with others is, you know, my healing medicine. Rishan right? asked Dawu, where are you coming from? Dawu said, I've come from tending the sick. Rishan said, how many people were sick? He said, there were the sick and the not sick. Rishan said, isn't the one who's not sick you? Dawu said, being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with him, the Dharmakaya, the Dharma, our fundamentally enlightened mind, him at all. Speak quickly. Rishan said, even if I could say anything, it would have no relation. So it's more wonderful than any words can convey. And this experience of Sashin with all of you is more wonderful than any words can convey. So we have, you know, we have a few precious hours left. We'll end as usual around 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and there are koans still to be worked through, obstacles still to be worked through. So everybody's doing a wonderful job. Please keep up the good work. Creating the pure land, yes?